It's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 386 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week I've got a great interview with Ryan Cady from Infinite Dark at Top Cow, which is one of the very best science fiction series out there right now. Issue 7 has just come out, issue 8 is coming, and it's a really great story that you really should read, particularly if you're a fan of science fiction or even sci-fi, and fans will know the difference between the two. We talk about how the book came to be, the characters, as well as what's coming from Ryan in the near future, and what kind of future Infinite Dark might have. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy what he has to say. There's a lot to get to, so let's get on with the show. It's great to welcome to the podcast Ryan Cady, the creator of Infinite Dark, at least a writer, among other good things. Written many good things. I was just talking to you about there, Ryan. Warframe, the Magdalena, which I have not read yet, and I'm interested to read. You were in the New Talent Showcase from DC one time.
Yes, sir, I was. Yeah, I did a Zatanna story for them with Isaac Goodhart. Yeah.
When was that? Do you remember?
That was this past December. Yeah, technically 2018. I think our talent year would have been 2018. So yeah,
good. I read that then because I read that new talent showcase and I like those kinds of things. I like when they give other people a chance to strut their stuff on characters like that.
Me too. It was a blast. Thank you for reading it.
That's really good. Now, why don't we dive right into the thing that I probably should talk about the most? I do want to mention though, I did enjoy Warframe Volume 1, which I
well, thank you.
That was great. I'm always a little nervous when there are video game things, because if I haven't played the game, well, I really get the story. And I did with this one. I really enjoyed what you were doing with that. I thought it was really
cool. I'm really glad to hear that. It's a tricky line to walk, you know? I mean, to do that knife edge between, especially with Warframe. I don't want to dive too much into it, but they're very, the way that they reveal lore in the game is very slow and steady, so it was certainly a challenge to make that accessible but not spoilery. So I'm glad that worked out.
I like that. Is there any more of that coming, or is that going to be it for right now?
It for right now, but you never know. I'm still on pretty good terms with those guys, so if something came up in the future, I would never say no. So.
Okay, very good. Well, I enjoyed it anyway.
Oh, thank you.
Make sure I get that in there. But I want to focus particularly on Infinite Dark, which comes from Top Cow, which is a company I'm falling in love with, which has all these wonderful things like Eclipse, Port Earth, mm-hmm. other things like that. I keep finding really good stuff that Top Cow is doing. And so that's why I approached Top Cow, and I was glad to find out that you were interested in talking. So Infinite Dark, even the title gets me. You know,
yeah.
Because, you know, I've read science fiction for a long time and sci-fi, and people who understand the difference between the two. Mm-hmm. This is more science fiction than it is sci-fi.
Yeah, well, I'm glad. You know, I mean, you know, obviously heat death is not necessarily the most, common accessible thing that people think about, but it's scary as hell. So to me, it's, you know, deep physics horror, I guess.
Yeah. You know, well, you know, it's science fiction always goes the what if routes, what I always like, you know, what if such a thing happens? And there's so many things about this book. As we're recording, as number 7 is coming out, and we have number 8 to go, which is coming out in July, which I'm really looking forward to see how this goes. But there's some things about this book that really I listened to some interviews that you had done, and I read some others as well. And there's some really interesting things about this that really gets me. You didn't know when you did this that you were going to do any more than a 4-issue series of it.
Yes, yeah. I mean, and you know, that's the way it is a lot of times with creator owns these days, especially, you know, if it's your first big solo series. And when I originally pitched it to Top Cow, I wanted to do a 5-issue set story, and it was going to be done. It was going to be 5 issues, and there was going to be no way to do any more of it. And after having a few conversations with the Top Cow team and Matt Hawkins, they were, you know, they were reluctant to do the full 5 issues, but they also said, well, what if we go down to 4 and we give you the option to, you know, depending on sales and how we all feel after the 4th issue is done, maybe we can go another route. And I was very, very pleased to see that those worked out. Enough people liked the book and supported it that we could, I could kind of tell the lingering extra and after stories that were sort of, like had to sit on the chopping room floor, once I made those 4 issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk to me about how you would describe Infinite Dark to somebody who may not have ever heard of it before.
Sure. I mean, you know, the sort of like elevator pitch is that, after the end of the universe, humans have survived in this space station and there's nothing anywhere. There's no matter, no time, no nothing. And, but we survived. And it's just about the lives of these people, you know, sort of coming to grips and maybe moving on to something new, but maybe just stuck there waiting. But the sort of plot and impetus that happens in the 1st issue is that, the first murder after the end of the universe happens and, there might be something otherworldly to it.
Mm-hmm. Or other, other galaxies.
Well, yeah, other reality, cosmic. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I don't want to give anything away, but yeah, it's. I was really spooked by parts of it.
Oh, good. I'm glad. That's my goal.
On the other hand, the characters to me, you know, science fiction. I mean, you know, Star Trek is based on characters that have lasted for generations, and
sure.
I think Infinite Dark does that too very well. Diva was my favorite, of course, and that's DEVA, not like a diva kind of.
Yeah. Thing.
I'm just kind of fascinated. Talk a little bit about the characters and how you developed them, because, you know, humanity has been basically pared down to this station.
Yeah.
And sure. Why, you know, why did you pick the characters that you did to be here on the station?
Well, you know, for me, Deva was sort of the first character that sort of sung to all of the plots, the setting and the story, because I, you know, much of Infinite Dark is about survivor's guilt and the notion of survival as a virtue, because, you know, the whole universe has ended and most of humanity is gone and everything's over, but these 2,000 people are alive, and the idea of, like, you know, that's a level of survivor's guilt that is hard to cope with, and you know, that kind of every character on the station is dealing with some mental health problems, as you would, some trauma. And that's a big part of the story overall is that everyone does go through these sort of therapy sessions, and the, you know, the chief medical officer as like a therapist is just as important as the, you know, Deva, the chief security officer, or Dr. Lynn Tennant, who is the sort of like head of HR, project manager, overseeing everybody. And so I really wanted to, you know, lean into these that as a background, because I think, you know, obviously everybody in life has to deal with various forms of trauma, but the idea of comparing people's thoughts on their own survival in the wake of horrible trauma, right? And for me, Deva is, as the main character, she's a cop, she's a security technician, but for her, you know, that doesn't come from a sort of traditional Earth setting, being a cop, being like a police officer, enforcing laws and protecting order and stuff like that. It's very much this, like, oh man, this is it. These last people are everyone in the whole everything, and it's my job to protect them. I have to keep them safe, make sure they survive.
So it's pronounced Deva, not Diva.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not, you know, like with my last name, Katie Caddy, I'm not too picky about people mispronouncing it.
Okay, because again, if people listen to this podcast, know that I'm big on lead female characters, especially ones that are interesting and not. I have these female friends, and I'm sorry that people hear the story every once in a while from me. that they expect a female lead to be maternal, talk their problems through, you know, not get into struggles and fights and stuff like that, but, you know, be very motherly in the way that they do things. But I don't think that that she's very motherly in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think we see, you know, there's a lot of that joking trope of, like, the quote-unquote strong female protagonist, where it's, you know, it's she's the main character is not a character, but she's a lady, and she's tough, and she shoots stuff, and that gets a lot of criticism online, and rightly so. You know, I mean, your characters have to feel real. And yeah, the maternal thing, you know, I hadn't much considered it too much there in that, like, that sort of relationship. A lot of me looming that far into the future is hoping to eschew a lot of the, like, traditional gender and racial expectations and problems that we have today. By leaping so far ahead in the future, I'm like, you know, maybe I can dilute those or not have to not address them as much, especially if they don't relate to me as an author. But yeah, definitely for me, Deva, you're right, it's not maternal, but it's also not action hero either, right? She's a person who wants to protect other people, like you said, not in a nurturing, like, stereotypically motherly way, but also not in an unfeeling way. It comes from an empathetic pain, you know.
She's a defender.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I like that about her. But again, I like that because there is some there is, I think, women are more defending than men are. Men are more exploring, going out there somewhere. So she's the perfect one, I think, to be in this situation where she is.
Yeah, I mean, I think for Deva individually, it's definitely you know, she was, you know, it's not really in the book too much. She mentioned it a couple times, but she was a normal police officer back on a planet somewhere before this was ending, and she was very much I don't think she was as much of a defender then. I think she was much more of an enforcer, a law and order type person. And I think going through this kind of, you know, what happened, and that's all obviously, you know, not in the book. This is just my head subtext stuff. But, you know, she, once we've picked up the story, she's in a place where she is very much like protecting, defending these people.
Now, I'm kind of intrigued by the fact that on this station, there are still corporate structures involved, which I got a kick out of. The one thing that, no matter where humanity goes, we're going to take corporate ways of doing things with us. And you've got like a project manager or something, and you've got, you know, all these different kind of business-like things, the way this is done. So I got a huge kick out of that. I mean, do you think that's going to go forward? Because, you know, like, I hate to keep bringing up Star Trek, but Star Trek is much more of a less corporate,
yeah,
you know, way of looking at things. But this, to me, I was intrigued by that you felt that the corporate mentality on some levels might actually follow us out to space.
At my most pessimistic, I do think so. I'd like to think that we wouldn't end up like that. I mean, it's one of the things that I didn't really get to explore as much in any of these issues, just because of space and it wasn't as integral to the plot. But you know, I think I explained it a few times in the book, is that, you know, there was supposed to be more time and more people on the Orpheus, the station. There was going to be up to upwards of 10,000, 15,000 people. They had all these plans, and most of those people didn't make it. And so instead of, you know, moving forward into a new sort of system, because there's so few people on the station and most of those people are the people who were building it and the people who are working on it, they've sort of assumed the de facto project structure, which is definitely corporate. I would say that probably being so far in the future, it's definitely less like aggressively capitalist, but there is for sure that sort of like, oh, well, these are the bosses, this is upper management, because these people were, you know, upper managing when they were building everything, and then everything went to hell, and these were the people they still look to, you know?
I got a kick out of that because, you know, I in the past, whenever I've read like science fiction, they almost never have any of this kind of corporate structure to it. It's always something different. It's almost more military the way
people
do stuff. So I was intrigued to see something a little different that went this way with it.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah, I definitely didn't. I didn't see it. Military sci-fi. People have told amazing stories in that genre and with that, but it's never been. It's never appealed to me as a creator. It's never been the kind of a framework I've wanted to set my stories in.
That's just amazing. One of the saddest things that happens in the very beginning is we find out that all these people were trying to get to the station, but apparently none of them make it. I mean, that's in the first couple pages of the book.
Yeah.
And I was so sad when I read that, you know, because, you know, the whole point of having the station and these other situations was to make it that humanity could survive. And really, the only, as you were saying, the only people that make it who survive this thing that's going on are the people that are actually working on the station.
So yeah.
I found that really interesting because, you know, you build something to save people, but then in the end, they don't get there. for some reason. Which I really like that.
I'm glad that rang true. And yeah, you know, it's definitely a dour book in a lot of places. I wrote it as an exercise in overcoming some depression and stuff like that. But I always maintain that ultimately the book is hopeful. If not optimistic, it is hopeful. You know, it is a lot of, yeah, you know, we didn't get to save the people that we intended to do, but we do still have that ship, and there is still this, you know, potential. You know, we're knocked on our feet, but we aren't out of the fight yet, you know, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Well, I like the idea that humanity can survive.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's one of the things, as I was reading the story, the point is brought up that humanity must, I guess is the word that they use, survive with yeah. those things, which I like, because, you know, I don't want to, there's so many things I don't want to spoil.
I know, it's very hard.
It's hard to talk about this because there's so many interesting things that go on, but I don't want to take it away from people. The way that you need to read this story is you start with one and you very carefully go from one book to the next, and things become revealed that are really important to how the story develops. But there is one thing I can bring up and talk about, and that's the computer name. Is it Smith or Smith?
Yeah, it's Smith. It's Smith. Yeah.
Instead of an I, he's got a 1.
Yeah, I just wanted to be silly with like the old leet speak thing. But he's Smith.
And the whole business with technolinguists and things like mm-hmm. that. People actually speak computer better than they do English or other human mm-hmm. languages. I found those really interesting because that's an interesting development because, you know, it reminded me, I had a friend of mine who had young kids that were like 2 or 3 and they were able to get on a computer and they were able to play games and do stuff like that, like as if they knew exactly what they were doing. And when I read that about this, I thought, wow, I've seen some of that in some of these people, some of these younger kids now that have been growing up with computers, who knows what they're going to develop into as time goes along.
Yeah, it does seem like the logical progression. You know, I kind of came up with that idea from there, and you know, the idea that when you're looking so far ahead, right, and when you're looking thousands of years in the future, you want to extrapolate really weirdly, right? You don't want to jump. You know, it doesn't want to look too similar to what you already have, or like, you know, I don't want a bunch of people walking around with P90s or just using things that seem like virtual reality we have now, or you know, really sort of digging into something weird. And so I wanted to do something with that, and I thought about I'm a big Dune fan, and I thought about the you know, the ship pilots who use spice to like calculate stuff and navigate and interact with piloting and astral navigation and stuff like that, and this idea that these people who are just like very, very different and interact with, you know, in Dune, it's just ships. There's no computers in Dune. But the idea of people who, they're still people and you can still talk with them and they're still, you know, normal and have their whole stuff, but they also can interact with computers and computer language in a way that we can't even fathom.
Mm-hmm. Which I like that because, you know, like I said, my experience was such, I've seen younger kids just take to computers like tremendously. And so I can see this developing over time. That there are people who like computers more than people, maybe.
I know a few people who like computers more than people.
So I like that about that. I like the way you extrapolated the things and moved things out, and to put this in a place. I did want to mention, because I was listening to an interview you did where you talked about the fact that you didn't want this to be overly dark or depressing.
Sure.
That there's hopeful things that we talked about, you know, humanity must survive and things like mm-hmm. that. And yet, you know, you have to build the story the way that you do. And I always like to point out to people that you've got to understand that you can't spoil things right at the beginning,
right.
Especially with your books. And I did want to say that it's a very intense kind of reading. The dialogue mm-hmm. is very sharp, but you've got to be able to you can't go on without understanding what has already been said.
Sure. Yeah. It's not breezy.
You can't, you know, like they're superhero books. Like, for example, I pick them up and I don't have to read half the word balloons on the page. Mm. I can look at the visuals and I get what's going on most of the time.
Sure.
With your book, it's very much you've got to read the stuff and be careful with it. Mm. You know, I read the first issue twice, in fact, to make sure that I got where this was before I moved into issue 2.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's hard with world building, you know, to not be wordy and to find that fine line between too much dialogue and not coming everything across. So it's definitely an exercise in restraint, but also the opposite for me.
Now, see, I've got to ask you about that because, you know,
sure.
You're going someplace that comics doesn't normally go. They don't normally do this kind of storytelling, the kind of thing that you're doing. So that was kind of a challenge, I think, on your part to make it accessible. You know, the language is such that we understand it, even though it's a little intense and we've got to be able to follow it very carefully. You know, because like I said, most comics don't do that. And so for you, I think that was a real successful thing that you did to make it something that we could read and understand and yet watch this story slowly unfold in front of us. You know, I really like that because, you know, I don't get a lot of that in comics these days. And of course, being a science fiction fan like I am, I miss that. So when I got to read this book, it scratched an itch that I haven't had, you know, satisfied for a long time. Something that made me think. You know, I was reading, but I was also thinking about what I was reading instead of just going, okay, this happens, okay, that happens. I had to think about this stuff. Like I said, with the knowing kids that had grown up with technology, I had to think all this stuff up, which I miss a lot of the times in comics. So I want to tell you how much I appreciated that.
Well, no, thank you. Seriously, from the bottom of my heart, that means a lot, and that puts a smile on my face.
Because it's just a great story. I mean, you know, I can't get into the stuff too much, but I do want to. There are some things that are science fiction-y things having to do with space and stuff that I have always wondered. Mm-hmm. You know, you touched a few subjects that, you know, you always wonder if you can't. Let's say you look up into space and it's dark.
Mm.
How do you know what's in there?
Right.
Because
right.
It's dark. You can't see it. You know, it's sunlight. You know, we get to see things, we get to find out what's going on, but it's one of the things that a lot of people want to go into space. I don't, because I don't know what's, you know, right outside of, if we were going in a spaceship, let's say, I don't know what's going to be right out there. You know, no. I'm just not sure. You tackle that subject, which I thought was, you know, I just sat there going, my gosh, you this is the kind of thing that I've always wondered about, you know, when I've read science fiction. So I once again, you touched on something that I just was glad to read, because I've often thought of these things and wondered about what's going to, you know, how can the Enterprise, for example, fly so fast without crashing into something?
Right.
You know, I don't understand how that happens, but, you know, of course, it's a wormhole kind of setup.
Right, right.
Stuff. Oh. But in your book, we get to explore different things than that. And I, being a science fiction fan, I like something different, and so I like that.
Yeah, I'm glad again. Thank you.
So are these things that when you were putting the book together that you were thinking about? I mean, was this, you know, trying to explore things that maybe other science fiction hasn't done that much?
A little bit, yeah, definitely. I so, you know, the notion of the inevitable heat death of the universe, that you know, every chemical interaction that there is, every physical interaction has like a entropic decay. There's like a loss of heat, and eventually, you know, in my book, for reasons that aren't important because comic books, it happens, you know, about 10,000, 20,000 ish years from today, whereas in reality it will probably happen a few billion years from now. But eventually all chemical interaction will cease and the universe will just be raw, empty entropy, nothingness. I mean, obviously, you know, that's a theory a lot of people believe in, but there's evidence that maybe not me. Anyway, assuming that happens, I learned about that in high school physics and it scared the hell out of me. I have a lot of fears of death, and survival is important to me. And obviously that's very in the book, but the idea that, you know, a lot of people talk about it's scary to think about climate change and the planet ending, and that's true. That is scary. I'm scared of that. But, you know, it's possible that humans could survive that. And even if humans don't survive that, it's possible that another species is out there doing better, or even our robots or a new species evolve on our planet, you know, that sort of thing. But here's this thing that is the end, absolutely. It's just the way that the atoms are working, and there's nothing to be done about it. And that was so terrifying to me. And so I'd always in my head wanted to do something with that. And when I started talking to Andrea Mutti, the artist, and talking about projects we could work on, I kind of took a lot of the bits and pieces off of an older, barely formed sci-fi pitch. And I was like, what if I throw it in this end of the universe place? And what if I make it scary? You know? mm-hmm. So I I really wanted to do that, and I wanted to explore it. And I'm grateful that really it hasn't been explored much. I'm trying to remember. There's a Capes, a superhero story that does take place after the end of the universe. I'm just trying to remember which characters it is, but regardless, it's mostly untrod territory.
Which is good. I like to go where I haven't been reading before. So for me, that's what I really liked about it, was the fact that it was something special and something unique. And to see something and to wonder if, you know, what if these things happened? You know, how would we react? See, that you mentioned a little bit about something that I'm fascinated too, is the fact that humanity doesn't necessarily take well to this. That, you know, you've got the very first issue starts out with Deva in a counseling session.
Right.
You know, and it's the computer that's counseling.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that really fascinating because, you know, the most stable personality that's able to do counseling is a computer.
Right.
Which I found that's something that's so interesting to me because, you know, so many people are scared of computers.
Yes.
The notion that computers are going to take over and, you know, they're going to be, that we're going to end up serving computers, which started out serving us.
Mm-hmm.
And to see how many people actually suffered as a result of all this. And yet the computer is the only one that seems to be logical and to treat people the way that we might want to be treated. You know, to start right off with that, I was right away transported somewhere that I haven't been before. Because, you know, we always have Dr. McCoy, the kindly doctor, right, and a talk and all this stuff. And in this book, we don't have that. Mm-hmm. You've got people who are in better shape than others, but most people are struggling really,
right,
really hard. I mean, you know, that's but see, you've put us in a place where we can grow. That's the thing I like about this book so much, is that, yeah, we're in a very dark, you know, the infinite dark place where things are really kind of bad for humanity at that place. But on the other hand, there are places for us to move to.
Yes.
I had a real trouble with the Next Generation because everybody was perfect.
Right.
No place for them to grow. By the end of 7 years, they were basically in the same place that they started. But with your book, there is room to grow. There's places for humanity to go and individuals to go to. And I really like that. And again, I can't spoil stuff. There's some changes.
Hard. It's so hard. I want to talk about, you know, you bring up Smith. He's really one of my favorite characters to write. And if Deva is you know, the idea of, you know, when I was writing this book, sort of getting over a depressive episode and sort of the notion of surviving and doing a lot of stuff. Smith is sort of the, even though he's the AI, right? He's not a human being. He is the belief in humanity, the indomitable spirit, the sort of like service as like a virtue. And just sort of like, that's why I made him a butler too, is that he's this idea of like, you know, to serve is in some ways the, you know, the best way you can lead and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. The Smith character, honestly, you know, it's so interesting to see the kinds of things that Smith would say to Deva and stuff like that. The kind of suggestions that the computer would make.
Right.
What I just found was so, you know, I wondered sometimes as I was reading it and I thought, you know, maybe it's going to be, you know, because we've always had people who had like computers built into them.
Right.
You know, which you don't have. At least I didn't see it.
Not really, no.
Yeah, so the notion that a computer that wasn't human was actually the most...
The most human.
Yeah, the most human. Said the stuff that like, for example, Deva needed to hear. You know, those kinds of things, and to go places and apparently did different things with different people.
Yeah.
I just found that such an interesting thing because sometimes there are counselors who always feel you have to treat everybody kind of the same. But Smith looks at everybody as something very different, and he's able to go and look at where people are and deal with that stuff. I found the Smith character really, I have to admit, Deva was my favorite, and then Smith came after that.
No, I'm glad to hear you say that. And honestly, Smith is, like I said, Smith is my favorite. And you know, again, it's hard because I want to just spoil stuff. I mean, what happened to him in this last issue, issue 7, everything that he did was some of my favorite stuff to write in the whole series. And it was, it was hard to write because it was the most, some of the most emotional I've gotten writing my own stuff. And I was like, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah. But it's great. You know, the thing of it is you, you know, though I was listening to the one of the interviews and you talked about how you didn't want it to be a depressing storyline. Mm-hmm. And you very could easily, and there's a lot of science fiction that is really depressing. I mean,
yeah.
I've read some stuff where humanity just blinks out and, well, you know, yep. That's it. It's all over with kind of stuff. And there's computers going on, but of course they can't repair themselves. Many of them can't, so it's the end of everything.
Right.
But what you do with this book is you give us, there is hope mm-hmm. in there, especially at the end of the first four issues. I thought there was a really nice feeling of hope that came along, and I don't know tell how, but there are things in there that I just came away thinking, you know, even in the darkest circumstances, there are still glimmers of hope to be found. And if we know where to look for it.
That's the dream. That's the goal, is to convey that. So I'm glad that you feel that way about it. That's if anyone could take thing away from Infinite Dark, it would be that, is that, you know, it's, you know, I, to not spoil anything, but there's that last line. A good friend of mine, actually, when she finished the book, she was being very flattering to me about it, but she quoted that last line, where not last line, but one of those last lines, where David, or the line is, you know, the shore is so much closer than you think, and that idea that, you know, even if you're on a lifeboat, that doesn't mean you're stuck at sea, you know. Help might be coming, or again, the shore might be closer than you think.
I also like the fact that not everybody survives.
No, it couldn't be a book called Infinite Dark if everybody got away scot-clean.
Because I won't say which one, but almost immediately somebody, you yes. talked about it being a murder mystery, there's somebody passes, shall we say. And
yes.
I right from that moment, see, when you do that kind of thing, what you do for me is you tell me everything's up in the air.
Right.
You can't. This isn't going to be a comic book where Batman has to be back at the end of the issue so that somebody else can write a Batman story next time. Your story is such, and your universe is built such, that we don't necessarily know that. And I like that. I mean, I like not knowing. You know, I as much as I love Batman, he's my favorite comic character, I get really bored sometimes. I mean, they recently were going to try to have him marry Catwoman. Mm-hmm. And I was excited about that. I said, I've never seen that before, him being married to Catwoman.
Right.
I mean, they married Superman off to Lois Lane, which I thought just was a tremendous move forward. Mm-hmm. And so with your book, I don't know where you're going with this. And I love not knowing. I love to pay attention and follow along and go with this stuff. At the end of the first book, the first four issues, shall we say, I didn't know what you were going to do.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I'm. That's always exciting to hear. Is that it's not predictable, and it leads you somewhere, and maybe it zigs or zags the way you wouldn't think, but it's yeah. but that it would still be satisfying, right? Because it's easy to bait and switch in an unsatisfying way. You know, it's
yeah.
easy.
Oh yeah. But the second series, I don't know if you call it that, or what.
I guess volume two. I guess is what I would say.
Yeah, it's volume two. It picks up on some of the threads from volume one and moves them further, but mm-hmm. in other ways it goes in a different direction, which I was surprised by. I mean, I literally sat there reading it going like, see, now I got to read number eight. See, I've read seven. I got to know what's going to happen in number eight, because, I don't know what you're going to do in number eight. I have no idea what's coming. That's why I got to read it.
Right, yeah. I won't spoil anything for you.
No, don't do it, because I want to know this stuff.
Yeah, well, most of volume two is a lot of the bulk of like what propels it forward is stuff that I back years ago when it was just like an idea for a 5-issue series that was one and done. You know, there was a lot of moments and story threads that would be background, like C plot, maybe even stuff. And what I was able to do with this, you know, with this sort of, the way the second volume worked out going for four more issues was that I was able to sort of put those kind of front and center and kind of evolve them a lot and really kind of get to push a lot of these characters where I had hoped or extrapolated they would end up with, and then sort of bring it all together at the end in the way that was the sort of intended conclusion for the series.
Now, when does issue 8 come out?
July. Oh, I don't know the exact date. I think almost exactly 5 weeks from tomorrow, or exactly 5 weeks from this Wednesday, I believe, whenever you're listening to this.
Yeah, it's I'm checking to see. Comixology says it's going to be available on July 10.
July 10? It could be. I think it should be. It should still be on schedule, but I'm not sure if that Comixology is 100% accurate.
Okay.
I think the 17th would be the absolute latest, but I think it's the 10th. I'm trying to look at my schedule now.
Yeah, because it looks good. I have to talk to you about the art.
Yeah, please do.
The art is really, you know, sometimes science fiction can be, the artwork is kind of clumsy.
Mm.
This is not. This is very intelligent art, if I can use that expression. There's a lot of thought clearly went from you and also from the art team into making this a really gripping visual along the way.
Yeah, Andrea and K. Michael Russell, they're brilliant. I love working with those guys. And Troy, the letterer, he's fantastic.
The image that we always see from the very first issue, I think it is on the cover, is Deva floating out into away from the station, shall we say. And we see the masthead above and stuff like that. And when I look at the cover, like for number 8, I mean, I don't know what it's really, really great piece of artwork, and it just, you know, that could be a poster as far as I'm concerned.
I would love for it to be. You know, and we were really lucky with those covers for the second volume, you know, in order to keep things moving and to with the change in tone for everyone's schedule and all that, we wanted to get a different color artist. And my buddy Nick Robles, who has just done his first Marvel work and a couple other little things like that, is a supremely talented guy. And I was just perfect for dark, moody, space, surreal stuff. And I was like, you know, I asked him on a whim, I was like, you wouldn't be able and available, would you? And he was like, actually, he's like, I have the perfect slot in my schedule. And he, you know, he was perfectly within our budget. And he turned around these roughs for the first couple. I was like, hey, something like this, something like that for all of the covers. And he just sent these rough layouts. And I knew like immediately, I'm like, oh, this is something special. This is perfect.
Well, like in cover of number 8, there's blues and purples.
Yes.
Involved with it. Like 7 has blues and reds. And I like the fact that he uses a lot of blue.
Yes, yeah, and it is. I think there's a lot of that tone in that second volume, even inside as well. Whereas I think the first one had a lot more like green and orange.
And I also have to give credit to the art, the drawing, because I never worry or was lost by who's doing what or saying what. It was always very clear who it is to me. In some comics, I get so mad when there's two brunette girls.
Right.
I don't know which one's saying or doing what. But with the artwork in this book, I never questioned who was going forward or doing what or saying what. So I really like that about the book, especially with the plot that you're doing. That was a real help to me. I really, really liked that because it gave me a chance to keep moving, and I didn't have to go back. So many times I have to go back and look and see, wait a minute, who said that or who did that? But not with this book. I think your plot, your story with the artwork was a great combination for a science fiction story like this.
Yeah, I mean, those guys are. I'm really blessed with that art team, and I'm really happy to work with them. And you know, Andre and I had been talking about working together on something forever, and it finally just sort of came together. And when he started sending me designs, I knew it was perfect. And you know, he'd already been working a little bit. Well, actually, he started the pitch for my thing before, but then it took a while, and then he ended up doing the Port of Earth book at Top Cow, and that's also sci-fi, but obviously a very, very different one. And so it sort of got him, he was in the vein to sort of like stick with that facet of genre, but go in a very different direction. And I think that plus just having K. Michael Russell, who had just done a bunch of work on Top Cow's Postal, which is, you know, that moody noir detective feel, kind of just propelling those two together makes for a heck of an art team.
You bring up a subject, though, I'm curious about.
Sure.
Why Top Cow? Because, you know, it took me a while to discover him. And once I did, you know, I've loved a whole bunch of stuff that comes out from Top Cow. Did you approach them originally? Was this one of the people you shipped it or you shopped it around to?
It's funny. I have a long relationship with Top Cow. You know, I've done a lot of work for them. I interned there when I was in college, and so I've always, you know, they knew that I always wanted to be a writer. And you know, Matt Hawkins, especially the president and COO, was always able to give me whenever there was an opportunity, and I kind of proved myself. And, you know, little backups and things here and there. Whenever there was a need for a fill-in writer or something like that, he was always able to give me those opportunities. And it's funny, I actually, when I was pitching this book around, I had a different book in the works at Top Cow that ended up falling through. because of the artist. It's not worth going into, but you know, too many people took too long, and then it had to just be dropped. These things happen. But while that was going on, I was pitching this book around as the 5-issue thing, and I was actually pitching it not to Top Cow or Image. I was pitching it more to companies like Oni or even more indie, because I wanted to go much weirder with it. And then when the other book I was doing at Top Cow fell through, I went to Matt and everybody at Top Cow, and I said, look, I have this other book. It's sci-fi, but it's not very mainstream. You know, what do you think about it? And they were very supportive from the beginning. And the only really change we made was making it longer. So
how about that? When they told you to write more.
Yeah. I was like, oh, don't mind if I do.
Not a bad thing to tell a writer, especially somebody who wants to be a good writer like this. This was such a great book. I'm pins and needles until number 8 comes.
No, I mean, you're flattering me. I really appreciate it.
I'm just dying to know what's going to happen next. But see, now this brings up the next subject. Is number 8 the last that we'll see from this universe of Infinite Dark?
Number 8 should be the end. As far as I know, this is it. We're calling it. This is the last issue. Okay. Now, you know, in comics, right, nothing ever stays dead. You never know. Depending on if there were film or television interest and things get adapted, or if, you know, there's a lot of resurgence in sales on the collected editions and stuff, I'd be willing to come back to it if it felt right. It definitely, issue 8 definitely ends on a way that I wouldn't call it just like it's over, but it feels like an ending. And it, for me, it's the ending that always was to this book. And so it's possible that if there was a lot of interest and things worked out, I could revisit the characters and the world, but it would certainly be a very different book. But I would be willing to do it if it worked out. But yeah, as you said, for now, this is the end of the saga.
What if it was Infinite Light?
Yeah. I don't want to say anything, you know, I don't want to.
Okay. Cause sometimes I look at these things and I think about this stuff. This is the stuff that keeps me awake at night. I wake up in the middle of the night and I'm going, what if we went this direction with the story? How would that work? Because I really like this, and I could see a different direction for this book. This could be on Sci-Fi Channel so fast. This would just be so great on there. It's just like The Expanse in many levels, I think.
Right. You know, it's funny. I have been meaning to watch The Expanse for a long time. I watched the first episode when it first aired, and I wasn't very – it didn't grab me right away, but I have a lot of friends who love it. So it's definitely on my list to dig into. But
yeah. That's good stuff. Well, you know – we talked about the fact that you had written some other stuff. What other projects are going on that we can look forward to that we should know about?
Yeah, well, my first full issue work from Marvel comes out next month. It's the Venom annual. It's the Acts of Evil. They're doing an event with a bunch of annuals called Acts of Evil, where it's kind of like people fighting people they wouldn't normally fight. There's a Punisher versus the Brood Queen by Carla Pacheco and Adam Gorham, and a couple other cool ones like that. And I'm doing Venom. I'm doing a Venom annual, and it's Venom versus Lady Hellbender, who is she's an awesome Hulk villain from a few years back.
That's different.
Yeah, it's very exciting. When they offered it to me, you know, they were like, "Do you like Venom? Do you want to do Venom annual?" And I was like, "Yeah, come on, who doesn't like want to do Venom?" And my editor mentioned that the villain they wanted to pair him with was Lady Hellbender. And one, I think that's really interesting because they're both kind of anti-heroes rather than straightforward, you know, like hero versus villain or bad guy hero versus supervillain. You know, it's two sort of on the edge characters, although she's definitely a little more of a bad guy than Venom is.
Now, Venom has gone back to being the original guy.
Yes, Eddie Brock.
Eddie Brock. Okay, that's the guy. Because he was off with Peter Parker's high school nemesis and...
Flash Thompson, yes, Agent Venom. That was
different. I don't know. See, there's a case where I think that would be better as a different character instead of a shift to Venom. But anyway, what do I know? I those things. So that's good. Do you know when that's coming out?
That is July. Let me see. July. Let me see if I can find the exact date. July 31st.
31st. Okay, so July very end. Month for you.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm very excited, actually, and I have Poppy coming out in July as well.
Really?
Yeah, so I don't know if you know, Poppy, she's a YouTube musician, and she's got kind of like a, you know, she makes really good sort of like synth electropop music, and it's got kind of a satirical edge. But she also has sort of this YouTube personality where it's strongly implied that she's some kind of cyborg. So I was able to work with the people who work with her and, you know, sort of put together this sort of graphic novel story about Poppy and her mythology.
Where's that coming from?
That's coming from Z2. They do graphic novels. They're more of a book market publisher, but they've announced a Grateful Dead graphic novel coming out, and they've done Baby Metal, and they've done a lot of musician stuff, but they also do a lot of work with music or comic creators who want to do book market stuff. You know, I think Cullen Bunn has done a book with them, that sort of thing.
Okay. So is that going to be Comixology by any chance?
It should be. Yeah. I believe so.
Because sometimes if I can't find the physical book, and sometimes my store doesn't necessarily order stuff that I don't order, so I have to be really careful. If I can't find something, I'll try to find a physical copy, but if I can't, I'll run to Comixology and get stuff.
So it should be on there. You know, it's funny. It's definitely about this musician and her music and stuff, but for a licensed job like this, I think it's one of the most like interesting and weird, surreal, satirical sci-fi things I've ever done. I'm actually really proud of it.
Very cool. There's a couple of things I was going to ask real quickly about.
Sure.
About, I'm interested because I'm always interested in religious and spiritual stuff. The Magdalena, mm-hmm. which I have not read yet. I'm interested in that. So I'm going to try to, there's a case where I might not find the physical copy, but I'll buy it off of Comixology because I'm interested in it.
You should be able to buy a physical copy off of the Top Cow store on their website. But if not, it's all on Comixology.
Okay, that'd be good. So I'm interested in those kinds of things. As much as I love science fiction, I also like spiritual religious stuff.
Sure.
Which sometimes crosses over each other, but not always. But I'm kind of interested. I'd be interested to see the take you're going to have on that.
Yeah, I mean, she was the concept of the character was originally used in the 90s as like a villain for the Darkness, you know, the comic, the Top Cow comic. And then, a few years back, Top Cow was asking me if I wanted to do any of their universe books, the properties that they own, you know, for hire. And I was really into this Magdalena character. But I wanted to tell a story about, they're a legacy. You know, there's a legacy of these warriors throughout time. And so I wanted to do a new one. And I got my good friend Teenie Howard, who is currently a Marvel exclusive writer, doing all sorts of cool stuff. And we got together and cooked up this volume of, you know, sort of urban fantasy horror Buffy style stuff that we're really proud of. Oh, good. I'm glad. Stuff.
One last thing I wanted to ask you about was Rolled and Told.
Yeah.
Is that a game, video game type setup, or what's the deal with that?
No, so it was a Rolled and Told was a like a supplemental periodical magazine type thing that Lionforge was putting out under Steens, Christina Stewart, the editor over there, and she's also done a book at Oni called Archival Quality. She's really fucking talented. She's an amazing person. She's no longer at Lionforge, but Rolled and Told was sort of her big dream project, and it was sort of kind of like the old Dragon magazine for D&D and a couple things sort of like that. And it was this idea of getting, as opposed to, you know, a lot of those supplemental periodical magazines for Dungeons and Dragons and Pathfinder and all those, you know, just get the people who make them to talk about them. But, you know, the idea here was instead it would get a lot more comic creators, book writers, novelists, that sort of thing, working with comic artists and illustrators and stuff to, you know, tell their stories, a lot of adventure paths, NPCs, tips and tricks, that sort of thing. So I actually got to do, it was an absolute thrill. I got to take a setting, a location that I had used in the Dungeons and Dragons game that I Dungeon Master for, and I got to take it and sort of change a few things about it and sort of, you know, deconstruct it so it could be there on paper so that other people could use it if they ever wanted to use it and give all the stats and information about everything that's going on there. And it was a blast. It was some of the most fun I've ever had.
I just remembered something I wanted to ask you about with Infinite Dark, and I don't want to go on without it. The columns at the back of the issues.
Yes, Dispatches from the Void, yeah.
Yeah, I really got into those things.
I'm so glad.
I was reading them, and I was, you know, the thing of it is it's interesting because, you know, comics were used to visual storytelling. Mm-hmm. But to actually have people talk about science fiction and, you know, talk about heat death and other kinds of things going on, in science and science fiction, I really enjoyed that. And of course, Philip Seavey is one of my favorites.
Oh, good. Yeah, I love Phil.
He does the Freeze, which I really yes. loved recently, and I got to read his column in there, which I really liked. So I think that's just a great one, a great way to do that, to make it a profound read to me. You know, to not only visually, you know, have me enjoy stuff and also the dialogue, but also to read someone's opinion like that is really kind of it made this book really kind of a real neat science fiction experience for me.
Good. I'm you know, that was my intent with it. You know, as I talked about in the book, and again, I'm you know, beating the dead horse, kind of, is that, you know, this book was exploring depression and trauma in a lot of ways, and my personal trauma, but also just the concept and survival and all that. And, you know, I had so many people in comics and out of comics give me support, and I found so much that this creating this book, and also, you know, reading a lot of horror and watching a lot of scary movies and stuff like that, was a kind of comfort. And I sort of wanted to talk about that intersection, and I wanted to let other people who were definitely maybe more experienced or a little smarter than me share their personal takes.
That's what got me to the called horror something of a comfort.
It can be, I think, for me at least, it often is.
I found that interesting because I don't. horror is like, I haven't really gotten into horror until really recently. Mm-hmm. I've always kind of avoided it because it's, you know, I when I was young, had nightmares about Bigfoot.
No kidding. I was also very scared of Bigfoot as a child for some reason.
I couldn't sleep at night because I was terrified. You know, here was this thing that was way out in the middle of nowhere, and somehow it was going to find me.
Yeah, I slept on a second story in the middle of the suburbs in California, but I was so afraid that I'd go camping and he would follow me back and be at the window. You know?
See, that's why I can't. Horror to me, it's only the last couple of years, like I said, that I've really gotten being able to enjoy it. But that's good because now I get to enjoy Infinite Dark, which is one of those great books that I'm so glad I've gotten to experience. You know, I'm going to be sorry when number 8 comes and it's all over with, but it's going to be, I can't wait to read it. It's like one of those things that when Deep Space Nine was on,
I'm actually watching Deep Space Nine for the first time right now. I've been watching it for the past month or so, and I love it.
It's just, see, I watched it when it was originally out, and when the 7th season came, we knew this was the last one, we would watch them, and it was great to watch them, but on the other hand, we knew eventually we were going to come to the last one, and we were so sad. When we was all over, that was part of a Star Trek club, and when that one ended, we all stood there and watched the end credits go by, because it was a great show.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
See, it's Infinite Dark should do the same thing. They should have a show, and we should be able to watch it and see what kind of good things.
Fingers crossed. You never know. There are things that are always in the works, and it's hard to make it actually happen. But you know, I'd really like that. I think it really lends itself to TV sure.
It does. If it was 2 movies or something, I think it would be great. Even if it'd be a weekly series like on sci-fi. Although you got to be careful with sci-fi because sometimes they tend to cancel something before.
Yes.
I meant to ask you what cons you were going to go to.
I'm doing San Diego Comic-Con, and then I'm doing New York Comic-Con, and then a Small Press Expo in September.
Well, Ryan, it's great talking with you. And, Infinite Dark. Top Cow, all these good things. July is Ryan Katie month. So you've got to be able to follow and get your good things and be able to read them. So looking forward to it. So, man, keep it up. We'll have to talk again sometime when you got
a
good thing going.
I hope so. And, yeah, thank you so much. And, yeah, I guess July is Ryan Katie month. So, well, awesome.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, from flesh and blood, I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
That's it for this week. Be back next episode when I'll have another terrific conversation with another wonderful comics creator. But until then, keep reading your comics.